We have a lengthy agenda, so I think why don't we start taking testimony, particularly on maybe if we take Senator Fredrickson. You've got a lot of folks from out of town, then by the time their testimony is over, hopefully we'll have a quorum. So would you like to start?
Chair, we're just still getting organized.
Oh, okay. All right, Senator Olson.
I my witness, I don't think, is here yet.
Yes.
Is he? Okay. I need Senator Bickerman. How long is it going to be?
What do you mean? Three things going on, so.
Talking about Senator Bickerman?
She needs Senator Bickerman. She's.
You need Senator Bickerman?
Well, he was supportive of it. He said he would be here for me, so.
Okay. Well, let's start the testimony, and we can. We're not going to be able to vote until we have a quorum anyway. And
sure.
Hopefully he'll
okay.
be part of the quorum.
Senator Pierce was right outside here. I think she's looking at her. She'll chase her.
Here she comes.
Well, we don't have myself, we don't so have about that. Great. Is this one going to take? Is this one going to take a while?
Yeah, I think so. Senate File 731, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, the DNR folks would like to be here also to discuss some fiscal impact, so I don't know if they're not here yet either, if you still want to go forward.
Yeah, go ahead and present your case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Bill 7... Senate File 731 is a bill that provides for free. Lost my bill copy. Sorry. Thank you. That provides for taking small game and deer, as well as actually angling and taking small game, for a 2-year period, and one taking of deer for National Guard and reserves that have come back from active duty, and it allows it for a 24-month period for the small game license and the taking of one deer. That is essentially what the bill does. And to this idea and suggestion was brought to me by our witness here, Larry Storr, and I'd like to have him testify to it.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, at Christmas time, my nephew was home.
If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself for the record, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly, sir. I'm sorry. Larry Stair from St. Bonifacius, Minnesota.
Thank you.
Say, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman. At Christmas time, my nephew was home on leave for 2 weeks from Iraq, and I got the chance to talk to him. And one thing he said he really missed, besides his wife and his three kids, was the fact that he wasn't able to sit in a tree stand this year or get out fishing. And I thought that it would be a very nice gesture on the part of the people of Minnesota to replace the 2 years that they've missed for fishing openers in Iraq and the year of deer hunting with the opportunity to do that, provided by the citizens of the state of Minnesota. So I proposed to Senator Olson and to Representative Steve Smith in the House that we do something to provide this in part of the veterans package when they come back. All of this is accomplished. I'm not in with all the nuts and bolts of the financial end of it. There's going to be some lost revenues, I guess, in federal sharing dollars. If that's a case where the licenses would have to be purchased at a lower rate so that we could qualify for the federal matching funds, then quite possibly that veterans organizations and sportsmen's organizations might want to provide some money in a pool to compensate the DNR for those licenses so that there would be some fees so that we could go and get the extra funds from the federal government. But beyond that, it was just a thought of mine that it would be a nice present, a little bit extra for the guys when they come home from spending 2 years away from their families and from the state, that they would have a chance to enjoy some of what we in Minnesota have enjoyed.
Okay. Was Mr. Bogus going to talk on, was Mr. Bogus going to, from the DNR, going to talk on this, Senator?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who they had planned to have discuss it, but Mr. Meyer, I think, is trying to brief, and do you have any?
Mr. Chair, members, we probably would both like to address.
Okay. Why don't you come forward?
Actually, I'm done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you does deal with licenses. I think the intent was for 24 months for people who are over there. I think the language we may need to look at a little bit, any time during the past 24 months. So this would include anybody who was over there 24 months, not our veterans who are our members who are there right now, but any time in the future as well. So it may have ongoing implications or financial impacts. We have been doing whatever we can for our veterans. Last year, we initiated a special hunter cap privilege for active military personnel. We've also allowed entrance into the state parks for free for active military personnel. They do receive fishing licenses, or they receive a hunting license. If you're active military, currently in law, you do get a free hunting license. And also, you do not need to have the firearm safety if you're active military. We issue without a fee deer hunting licenses for them. So we do a lot of things. We're trying to do whatever we can. One of the things we've been trying to get our arms around are the fiscal impacts of this bill. We discussed several pieces of legislation last session that would give lifetime licenses to veterans of the war on terrorism, the bill was worded. That did have some huge fiscal impacts, about $750,000, $800,000. And our position at that time was, as long as the Game and Fish Fund is made whole, we don't have a problem with that. I think that's our position on this bill as well. As long as we can maintain the integrity of the Game and Fish Fund, sure, that's great. And that's a decision if this body would like to do that. We will do whatever we can. It also will impact the electronic license service agents because it says they must be issued without a fee. Right now, those ELS agents are getting $1.50, I believe, commission for each transaction as well. So there will be a small impact out there, but not a really large impact. But the ELS agents are ones that I know some of you hear from often, your constituents, about how they operate that system and their costs as well. So with that, I'd like to have Ed Bogus just discuss some of the draft fiscal impacts we have at this point in time. And as this bill moves forward to finance, we can further define the fiscal impacts of the bill.
Senator Olson or Mr. Meyer, do we know how many National Guard and reserves this encompasses? What's the universe of people we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, someone said about 2,600.
Okay.
That assumes that everyone would take advantage of this this opportunity. I'm not certain. I should have done my homework on this, but I believe the Senate passed a bill increasing the fees for the folks that administer licenses that hadn't gotten from $1.50 up to $5. Is that just notaries, or is that for all of the licensure people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's just for, it must be for notaries. It didn't impact our electronic licensing system revenues. And one question I have about the language, Mr. Chair, 11 lines 1.11 to 1.12, that at any time during the past 24 months, does that carry this into the future? That past 24 months isn't really set in time? Maybe we could get some clarification on that.
Mr. Chairman, what is meant by that, if they have served in the past 24 months, they would be eligible up. It'll be a closure It isn't an open-ended forever, so they have to have been active within the past 24 months to have, a year from now, they will only have 12 months, so they have to have been active within the past 24 months. So the clock does tick down, and it does end.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Knopf.
If I could just clarify, what Senator Olson said is correct, but I think what Mr. Meyer is talking about is whether or not this is going to be on into the future, whether like 5 years from now somebody comes back, it's a 24-month clock tick for them, too. The way this is drafted, the way I understand it, it would continue. So somebody 5 years from now coming back from active service, if they're a member of the Guard or Reserve and they're active overseas, then they would also be able to get this license. But as Senator Olson characterized, it's a limited window for the individual. It's 24 months after it's 2 years after they get back.
Mr. Chairman, if it's, and I think it's perfectly appropriate if you one did put a sunset date on that, which could, of course, be extended if there's some assumptions that things might be ending in the not-too-distant future, if that, in fact, continues, and this in fact, is implemented, it could be extended. So if it would be more manageable in terms of this to put a sunset date on it or an end date, I think that's appropriate.
Mr. Chair, members, the reason why I ask is it will impact our final fiscal note calculations on what the bill, if it's going to be open-ended from now into the future or if it's just for the people who are there currently. So something we can work on into the future as the bill progresses.
Okay. Senator Olson, how are you anticipating that the servicemen prove that they were in active duty over the last 24 months to an ELS agent?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Stern, could you might you be able to respond to that?
Mr. Stern, again, thank you. The envision was that when the returning veterans, I'm sure that they'll be getting a package of information from the state for tax purposes, educational benefits, and everything else, that a letter with an application form could be included in that, which they would fill out and send in. And then as far as the ELS agents go, what the DNR could do is possibly issue a little card similar to my lifetime license, and that, along with the picture ID, would be proof that they are eligible for that in case they would get stopped by a CO and checked. This would also, I did not envision that this license would include any special stamps or any other special fees involved. This just strictly a basic license.
What was the deal about they already can get a hunting license, Mr. Meyer? I didn't understand what you said. Can they already?
Mr. Chair, members, existing law does allow active military personnel who are residents of the state of Minnesota to receive a free hunting license. It just says that the commissioner shall issue a tag, so they will bring in their papers. It's not a DD-214, but that's what you get when you're discharged. You would bring in your active military papers and show them to the ELS agent, and then they will issue you, without a fee, a deer hunting license.
Do you recall how many of those have been issued recently?
Yeah. For deer? Is that only applicable?
Don't know.
Mr. Chair, it's something we can get back to you on.
It's also broader than just
deer. Mr. Knopf, how does the current law differ from what Senator Olson is proposing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, how it differs is this is only for residents who are on leave at the time. And, in fact, it doesn't require it. It allows you to hunt and fish, so you could actually fish without a license under this as long as you have your official military leave papers on your person at the time. And then, in fact, if there's like small game hunting where there's not a requirement for a seal or a tag, you would not have to have. You would also be able to do that small game hunting with that with your official leave papers, without even contacting anybody. Based on this, the only time you have to contact the commissioner is when they have to obtain or an ELS agent is when you need a seal or a tag beyond the license.
But that's for only people on leave. This is after they've returned. This is while they're officially on leave. Senator Olson's bill deals with after they've returned from active service. They're not on leave anymore. They've returned from active service.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
maybe we can put a sunset date on it. That doesn't bother me. I'm not worried about the money, because those soldiers that are over there, they can give them all free licenses, if you ask me. Maybe they need to do that, just do a little fishing to kind of get their mind off of where they've been. Because that post-stress is really, really going to start to hit us. There's 12 suicides already that took place. I can't think of a better way to reward our soldiers that have been there. If you want to put a sunset on, we can see. I'd like to tell you the war is going to stop tomorrow, but I'm afraid I'd be lying to you. So if we could put like a sunset for, I'm going to say 2 years, and then we can come back. Just a suggestion. I'm going to do it yet. But, Mr. Chair, what do you think?
Before you walked in, Senator Vickerman, the DNR was talking about the Game and Fish Fund.
Okay.
And trying to figure out what kind of impact this would have on the Game and Fish Fund. We're not sure yet. The DNR's position, it seems, is that they don't have any problem with doing this, but they want the Game and Fish Fund to stay whole. And the Game and Fish Fund is having issues at the moment as well, particularly with there's been some discussion about how hunting money is used for fishing issues and whether there are deficits between those two categories. So they're kind of dealing with internal issues as it is. So their concern is that policy-wise, great gesture. No problem doing it. In fact, maybe we should do it for all active duty armed forces, not just reserve or National Guard. Let's include active Navy, Marines, Air Force. But we just need to make sure the Game and Fish Fund is whole, because if we take money out of the Game and Fish Fund for programs that facilitate fishing, then there's really no point in giving these folks a free license if there's no, if we don't have adequate ways to fish or hunt. And that's what the Game and Fish Fund is used for, to provide that opportunity. So we need to figure out the money part of it.
Mr. Chair, then, while you're figuring out the money part of it, I want to know how many thousands of dollars they spent killing deer up northern Minnesota. Some guy, $300 and some a deer. Mm-hmm. That comes out of the hand of this fund. Somebody has to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like a report of that when we get this point. So I just thought if we could put a sunset in, it can lay on the table, or it can be, so we find out a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I'd feel better if we put maybe a sunset instead of going out. That's just my opinion. It's Senator Olson's bill.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I would consider it a friendly amendment to include all active duty if you wish to do that. I could not hear much of Senator Vickerman's comments, too, but I had attempted to have some discussion on this issue with the DNR, and our schedules never seemed to coordinate. So I'm not sure how much of a license, how much of a fee is required in order to trigger the federal funds. But I think it's is it a dollar? Is it a fairly small amount per license that
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, at this point in time, I think it'd be appropriate to hear from Ed Bogus, who does have some preliminary fiscal impacts of the bill, if the committee would allow.
Let's hear it.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for DNR, and we do have some very preliminary numbers right now. Based on 2,500, which sounds like it's in the ballpark of Senator Olson's estimate, if they all chose an angling license, that's about $42,000 a year. And our understanding of how this bill would work, they could do that for up to two consecutive years, or if there's a sunset, we'd have to factor that in. We haven't done all the detailed fiscal analysis. If The deer license is the most expensive license, so if they chose a deer license, that's about $65,000 a year. You know, if all 2,500 chose all three licenses, we'd be in the vicinity of $150,000 per year in direct revenues, and then there's the federal aid. Reimbursement that Minnesota gets is based on numbers of licensed anglers and numbers of licensed hunters. So there would be a loss of federal aid because that's in a formula. That's from federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment that gets apportioned back to each state based on a formula of geographic area and number of licensed anglers and hunters. So there would be some additional revenue loss from the Game and Fish Fund due to that loss of federal revenue, because they don't count free licenses as being licensed hunters or anglers. And I don't know exactly what that amount is, Mr. Chairman.
The federal match is based on the number of licenses, not the amount of money in the fund. So if we were to compensate that fund with another pool of money, that would not trigger the match, is what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We looked into this issue quite a bit last session on a House bill that was being proposed, and we talked to the federal Fish and Wildlife Service people, and they said that the state paying the Game and Fish Fund for those licenses with general fund money still would not trigger the federal match. It has to be – it's based on individual people who purchase – fishing licenses and hunting licenses, and they're trying to avoid situations where states give away or have lots of really low-cost licenses to increase their share of the apportionment. So that's why they have this kind of threshold that an individual has to pay to be counted as a licensed hunter or angler.
And you might be doing some additional work on figuring out how much of that federal loss might be.
Mr. Chair, yes, we just had started working on this week, and we haven't had time to, and we didn't quite understand the entire intent of how this was going to work. So we will be doing that, but we don't have it today.
Okay, and so maybe we should. One of the things Senator Vickerman was saying, Senator Olson, is that he would support a sunset in 2 years. So maybe that would help the DNR in their figuring. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. as they're taking a look at, as the department is taking a look at the issue of you know, the kind of federal dollars that wouldn't be matched, it's probably important to be cognizant that not everyone who takes advantage of this license opportunity would necessarily have gotten a license previously. I don't know if you made that point earlier, Senator Olson, but. You know, I can well imagine that there will be new people, you know, in the pool of licensed fishing, you know, fishermen and fisher people and hunters. So it's not as if though there will be a loss. I'm sure some would have gone and bought themselves a fishing license or a hunting license, but many maybe wouldn't have. So we probably need to figure out the net losses, because just because someone has got a free license doesn't mean it's a loss per se, because they wouldn't have otherwise. Mm-hmm. Gotten a license.
Mr. Bogus, could you maybe
I don't know if there's a way to figure that out. But.
Maybe also calculate how much it would be to give these folks a lifetime license?
Mr. Chair, yes, we could. And to Senator Dibble's point, we had talked about, you know, we weren't sure of what the universe of National Guard members who might be taking advantage of this was. Now we know that's in the 2,500 to 2,600 range. We could apply a percentage to that that's the same as like 30% of the population fishes. So if 30% of 2,500 would get this license, that might be a better representation of the lost revenue, even though additional people might get it who normally wouldn't. So we have not done a very sophisticated analysis of the fiscal impacts of this yet, but that is something that we're considering.
I think it'd be worth asking the Department of Military Affairs as well what their thoughts are on the number of people this would affect. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, why doesn't this cover active duty? Why doesn't this cover individuals who served on active duty as a regular member of the armed forces? It covers reserves and National Guard.
Mr. Chairman, I just that I would consider that a friendly amendment to extend. It's drafted now. It does.
Senator Fredrickson, maybe you want to take a look at line 14 and maybe just move to strike the word reserve. And then that would then say or other component of the United States Armed Forces.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to go about it a little different way. I'd move on line 13, strike the word or, insert a comma. And after, on line 14, after forces, insert our active duty member of the United States Armed Forces.
That works, too. Do you want to move that?
I'd move that, yes.
Does the committee understand the amendment? Does the council have that?
Fine.
Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Fredrickson Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator?
If they're going to get Fickerman. A handle on what this is going to cost, I think they're going to put a sunset.
Okay. Do you want to move that sunset?
It's for the funding division.
Otherwise, how are we going to know how to...
Sure.
I don't know if there's other issues here that DNR has, but I don't know what your pleasure is. Retain it if there's further policy issues, or if some of the issues could be resolved if you send it to finance.
We'll send the entire Senate file on to finance.
Okay.
But we'll hash out some of the policy here.
Mr. Chairman, would the sunset be a finance issue or a policy issue?
I think we should just do it here, and that would help the department in figuring out the numbers between now and finance.
Mr. Chair, then I'll move we sunset it in 2 years, if that will work.
Can council?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the best way to do that is a license year ends on February 28th. But you may want to be a little more than 2 years, but what I was thinking is you could, on line 1.10, insert paragraph A, just insert A with the parens. And then insert a new, after line 1.15, insert a new paragraph B that says this subdivision expires on February 28, 2010.
And I do that, Mr. Chair, so that when you go to the finance, wherever it goes, they can figure out the amount of money. Otherwise, it could be open-ended. I don't think you'll get it through there.
Right. Okay, on the Vickerman motion, does everyone understand the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Do you have any other testimony, Senator Olson?
There might be someone here who has his view.
Okay. Mr. Kelleher, do you want to come up?
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I just have a couple of comments. We had our corporate board meeting about 3 weeks ago in Mankato. We reviewed about 18 different proposed deer hunting type legislative activities at the state capitol this year, three of which were Senator Olson's bill for free licenses for the National Guard and the Reserves, Senator Metzen's bill for free licenses for the disabled, and I can't remember who authored it, but a bill to reduce non-resident youth licenses. My corporate board is made up of about 100 gentlemen representing 68 chapters statewide. We have about 20,000 members. We have opposed in the past all sort of specialty group individual classes of people free licenses. We are opposing all the three bills that I just mentioned before for two reasons, basically. One is because of the specialty type issue that where do these different classes of people sort of start and stop? How many times are we going to do these? The legislature is going to propose to do them. And the second thing is, as you alluded to, Mr. Chairman, the discrepancy in the spending at the DNR between the fisheries and the wildlife division. The Budget Oversight Commission at the committee at the DNR 2 years ago noticed that spending was not keeping up for wildlife and that fisheries was in a deficiency to the tune of about $11.8 million. In the last four bienniums, fisheries has had overspent monies versus their revenues. What I'm saying is that what they've collected in fishing licenses has been less than what they've been spending on fisheries. It was $2.7 million more in expenditures than revenues in 2002-03, $4.6 million in 2004-05, $9.1 million in 2006-07, and is proposed in the governor's current budget, 2008-09, of negative $8.7 million. And those dollars are coming straight out of wildlife funding. I've been using the word gypped or skimmed or whatever you want to call it, but those monies are not being appropriately spent on wildlife and are subsidizing fisheries. So I think in the context of that, the context both of the three free licenses that I was describing, or the two free ones, and the reduction in the non-resident youth licenses, and then there's a bill proposed to add a dollar to the deer licenses for venison processing, which we're also opposing, sort of take all those in conjunction with one another, that sort of why the gentleman on my corporate board came to the conclusion that we're opposing Senator Olson's bill. Strictly on financial reasons, I would say.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
So he's trying to make me carry the whole load of all their opposition.
Thank you, Senator. No,
I think you're bearing the brunt of their angst, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, it's interesting that in some areas of the state we are very much overpopulated in the wildlife, and in other areas perhaps it may not be the case, but I don't think this would diminish that much. But I'm totally sympathetic to the issues of finance, and I think that they ought to be examined carefully. So if it's your pleasure when you're ready, I would move that this Senate File 731 be recommended pass and re-referred to finance. And in the meantime, I will commit to seeing if we can't find some resolution and a way of doing this that would, I think, serve the intent and yet not put undue limits on the resource.
Maybe we could look at whatever you want to do with your bill, Senator Olson, but maybe you could take a look at the existing law. Maybe that can be tweaked somehow to
sure.
to serve the purpose without impacting the fund. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Keller. For or against? Okay, seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 731 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there further discussion? On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Members?
Senator Dill.
Two bills on River and River Trails. Okay.
Senator Dill, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I have a handout here that's being passed out. So this Senate file is. I'd like to amend it to start with. There's an author's amendment that I'd like to pass on and get the bill in the form that I'd like to have it in. And Mr. Chairman, members, maybe I can just start out by saying this is a simple bill to clarify that the South Fork of the Curl River is also a designated DNR canoe route. The existing law, you'll see it in the delete all amendment that's being passed out, there's a list of rivers in the state that are part of the canoe and boating routes that are maintained by the DNR. And the last river listed is the Crow Rivers.
Now, I live on the North Fork of the Crow River, and that is maintained by the DNR and marked and so forth on their maps, and along the route is an official canoe route. The South Fork, we're assuming the South Fork is also part of the DNR designated canoe routes, but it's not maintained as a canoe route. And so to clarify, we're adding the words to the bill that both the North Fork and the South Fork of the Crow Rivers, which is what it's called after the forks joined together, are all part of this DNR canoe route. And then there's an appropriation of $60,000 to do the marking and provide the access points and so forth. Now, Mr. Chairman, members, I passed out a letter from the South Fork Crow River Association, which is asking for this change, and also an editorial from the Hutchinson paper from January 18th, 2007, supporting this idea. There's a very active Crow River Association in Hutchinson. I'm passing around a map, which is at the Center Parasol and Fredericton level right now, but this map is prepared by the South Fork Crow River Association and identifies part of the canoe route in the Hutchinson area. It doesn't identify the entire route, which is over 100 miles long and joins the North Fork at Rockford, Minnesota. But I'm passing this around to show you that there's an active group that's very interested in getting this route designated and maintained by the DNR as an official canoe route. So that's the end of my presentation, Mr. Chairman, and if I could get this amendment, well, I'm on the committee, I guess I'll move the A1 amendment.
Senator Dill moves the A1 amendment. Discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Say aye. Opposed? Period. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, the first half of your section one of your bill is entirely policy. Section two would pull this bill into finance committee. Yes, I'm wondering in my mind if you want the whole bill to go to finance committee or if you want to separate those two sections.
It's your bill, Senator Dill. Or maybe Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, it's my understanding that you wanted to make sure that you got the signs out there. Without the appropriation, you won't get the signs, probably. And so I guess you could pass it. There is a fiscal cost. In fact, Senator Fredrickson, I think you have a bill up later that designates a river. It could be passed as a policy bill, but the signs, as I understand it, the fiscal cost is about the same, about $60,000 to do the signing. And without the appropriation for that, the department doesn't have the resources to put up all the signs and markings and work with the local groups in providing access and campsites.
Mr. Chairman, this is an ongoing program for the Department of Natural Resources, and they do manage those canoe accesses. Certainly, if there's an appropriation for a specific river, the money would go to that river, but there's also a general program for river, canoe, and
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, the last few times that the legislature's made changes to this law, in fact, I think it was just last year, there was money appropriated from the water recreation account to take care of the signing. And Senator Dill's, the way this memo was drafted, was to basically do it in the same manner as was done for those two rivers that were added last year.
Would you suggest, Mr. Knopf, that it go together?
Well,
stays together?
Mr. Chairman, it can go together. The first part can be part of another bill, and then later on they would get the signage. But I think if Senator Dill is looking to get the signs up, you'd want to have this go to get together over to Finance Committee.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I will follow Mr. Knopf's advice, which is what I usually do.
I want to put the same amendment on.
Okay. Other questions? Maybe comments? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I think I haven't observed. Now, this doesn't cover it. You said this doesn't show it all the way to Rockford, but the the intersections between the South Fork of the Crow and the Loose Line Trail, and there's some neat connections there that I think would be very, very appropriate to get this designation into law. I don't know, as you said, are they going with specific appropriations for signage on each one, or is there in fact you would think we would have a program that if there is some designation there, that as funds are available within an ongoing source of revenue, that you wouldn't have to appropriate for each one that comes along.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the issue here is that these are one-time expenditures. We don't have an ongoing program for the one-time expenditures. You'll see in the appropriation language, the last line says this is a one-time appropriation available until spent. So it's basically for doing that one-time work. And as I understand it, there's not, and somebody from the department could speak to this, there's not money set aside to do these as rivers come up. To do this, mm-hmm. So generally, what the legislature does is appropriate additional money from the water recreation account for this purpose when a river is added.
So, Mr. Chair, we don't just go adding designation without. I mean, I could see you could the policy of adding this as a designated trail could be separate from somebody doing a line item in the finance budget to cover signage for this. Yeah.
I believe this is designed to make sure that the signage occurs.
Yes. No, I understand that part.
Okay.
I was kind of trying to understand Senator Fredrickson's comments about whether part of it could go on its own, whether it needs to stay together with the appropriation, or I'm not sure I was clear in what your intent was in your comment, Senator
Chairman,
Senator
Olson. Fredrickson. In a previous year, several years ago, I added by an amendment to a bill another river to this list you see here, and there was not an appropriation with it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Other questions?
Just send the whole thing over to finance.
Yeah.
Senator Dill, in your opening comments, you said it was a simple bill, and we're still sitting here. So, would you like to move? Would you like to move it now?
Yes, I'd like to move this bill. I don't have the number in front of me, but number. Let's see, what number is this bill?
Senator Dill moves Senate File 115 as amended. To finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Committee will turn to Senate File 366. Senator Fredrickson. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 366 would designate the Redwood River as a canoe route, and there are some maps being distributed to you to look at. I also have given to committee staff letters of support from three of the cities that are along this canoe route. The Redwood River is a river about 70 miles long. About 70 miles long that begins southwest of Marshall and flows to the Minnesota River at Redwood Falls. At Redwood Falls, there is a created lake by a dam that was built almost 100 years ago that's going to be dredged and restored. This does have use now as a canoe route with all the activity that's going on in the area. I think it should be designated as a canoe route and some of the amenities provided. I have Mr. Jim Deering from the Redwood-Cottonwood River control area here. We'll tell you a little bit about the river and these maps.
Welcome, Mr. Deering. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Deering. I'm the executive director for the Redwood-Cottonwood River's control area. We're an 8-county joint powers organization that is working to lower the impacts of both the Redwood and Cottonwood River and pollutants to the Minnesota. And in addition to that type of work, we also are working to increase recreation and usage of the rivers. And specifically here today, we're in support of the Redwood River canoe and boating designation as the amendment that's before you. Before you, I made up some maps to show you a different canoe routes that we have been using currently with the programs that we operate. Annually, we take we do a canoe trip on the Redwood River, which ranges between 20 and 50 people, to get them to appreciate the river, look at it in a different light. As you can see on these maps, you see a lot of production agriculture, and that's predominantly the business around the area. And the first comment that I get from people when they're sitting on the river, you would not know that you're going through this type of landscape. Most people feel that they're heading down somewhere up in the Boundary Waters canoe area because all you see is hardwoods and nice trees on both sides. And we hear that comment quite regularly, and people that have lived there all their lives, we take down there for the first time, and they just are amazed to see this type of scenery that they've taken for granted. So this canoe and boating route designation would, A, get the signage up there, like you, Mr. Dill spoke about before. Plus, it would also allow trails and waterways with the DNR to focus on that, getting some canoe route or canoe access points, specifically on some of the points that I've put in front of you today, referring to the small little map that's in front of you. Access point 1 and access point 3 would be readily available because they are both wildlife management areas, and the wildlife manager and trails and waterways have spoken about putting canoe accesses there. So this designation would expedite the process.
Mr. Chairman, are there any questions about this?
Senator Dibble. I just had a technical question. The previous bill says canoe route designation. This bill says canoe and boating route. I see the legislation says canoe and boating route. Is there a distinction, or is that a difference without a distinction?
Are you looking at me, Senator Dill? Let's ask
through you to
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, titles are you know, whatever you need to have on the title. It is a canoe and boating route. You can see in the language on 1.8, it does say mark canoe and boating routes. So I guess the appropriate title would be the way this one is done, canoe and boating route. But whether it says canoe route in the title, I don't think it matters a lot.
Senator Dibble.
Well, I'm wondering if it matters practically if we're trying to market for canoes and not speedboats, or I mean, if there's a practical distinction in the real world.
Senator Frederickson, do you want to weigh in on that?
Mr. Chairman, I have nothing to add to that. It's the head note. The title of the bill describes what's in the bill. Mr. Chairman, having learned from Senator Dill, I would like to amend into this bill Section 2, content that was in Senator Dill's, which makes an appropriation of $60,000.
Now I understand the question.
Saves having to print that amendment again, doesn't it?
Pardon?
Saves having to print the amendment again.
Senator Frederickson has moved an amendment to his bill. Questions on that? Everybody understand what amendment he's referring to? Senator Stump?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't, and I apologize.
I have it here.
Senator Stump, if you'd look back to Senate File 115, which we dealt with earlier, mm-hmm. Section 2 on that, in amended. Delete everything amendment refers to $60,000 in one time appropriation for proper signage.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Frederickson, are the other rivers that are currently named in the statute, do they have signage? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, I do not know if they all do. I have canoed some of them, and I know that they have signage, and I know that they have canoe access.
The ones that have money appropriated, probably.
The intent of the program is to provide signage and canoe access on these rivers, and canoe and boat, I guess it is.
Senator Anderson?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, I don't know if this is it's something we'll have to either find the answer to now or in the Finance Committee, but And we can maybe ask Senator Deal also where the number comes from, 60,000. I mean, are these the same? Do these have the same number of signs? It also mentions campsites. How do you know how much it will cost to designate this route?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, my intent is to get the bill to your committee where we'd have that discussion with the Department of Natural Resources to determine what would be required to adequately sign it. I don't know that 60,000 is the required amount. My suspicion is that the Redwood River would not require that much.
Senator Anderson, in Senator Dill's bill, the fiscal note determined that $60,000 would be the approximate cost of proper signage. Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, reading the letter that accompanied Senator Dill's information, one of the paragraphs said that, the canoe route designation costs the state little or no money. They were asking, essentially, to get that designation on the state's printed maps so that it was designated. And it also says in the next paragraph, they've been adding, it says, we intend this group, the South Fork Crow River Association, we intend to add up to three more canoe landings in 2007. Two fine canoe accesses at boat landings in Hutchinson received canoe landing signs from our group in 2006. So in some cases, it appears that some of the local groups are doing the signage, and that wouldn't necessarily have to be a state responsibility either. So if I'd certainly hate to see the designation dragged down by the appropriation. If there's other ways of accomplishing it for either of these proposals.
Senator Knopf, did you have a response?
Mr. Knopf?
Yes. The only thing I do want to say, as Senator Olson clarified, is that if you look at the language in the appropriation, Senator Dills, it says to cooperate with local units of government in marking routes and designating river accesses. This does not provide all the money for all the marking. It certainly doesn't provide money for campsites. If there are ones identified, that could be used in bonding down the road. And I just wanted to point out that both Mr. Mueller just stopped by, and both bills had the same fiscal note of $60,000. I think that's kind of a standard for this type of bill. And I mentioned to him last year, I think it was 60, the cost is going down or something, because last year I think that the two rivers that were put in last year were $65,000 apiece. This year they're $60,000 apiece.
Senator Dill.
I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, in Hutchinson there's a dam which forms two lakes on the north edge of town, and there's parks and there's boat access points, and the letter that Senator Olson is referring to is indicating that the people from Hutchinson, of course, have done a lot of work in that particular area, but the river itself is 107 miles long, I believe. The DNR has estimated here in this fiscal note that just on average, a typical river, the typical cost is about $60,000 for a river, and that's what they're going by. Senator Frederickson, they're just... It says here, based on their experience, it takes approximately $60,000 to establish a newly designated canoe route. Now, I live on the North Fork of the Crow River, but I got 640 acres on the river, 2.25 miles of the river channels on my farm, and I can see the river clearly from my house, so I can see these canoers going up and down the river. Now, the question came up about boats and canoes. Is it a boating route, canoeing route, and so forth? And I can say that probably 98% of the vessels on the river are canoes, but occasionally you see a rowboat, a small motor boat, or a duck boat, or something like that going down the river.
Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I remember Mr. Deering mentioning that this is a part of an 8-county joint powers. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is there... do they have taxing authority, or do they have funding authority in either case to help with the costs?
We don't have taxing authority granted to us. Each county would have its own right to levy on a special project if they wanted to. Traditionally, in the area on the Cottonwood Rivers, the accesses have been matched by special interest groups like the hunting groups. And the Trails and Waterways have matched it and worked together to get in an access.
I wondered if that may have been an expectation then for not putting an appropriation in this originally. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, in order for myself, we're primarily grant funded. I would have to come in for a state grant
through normal avenues to try to get this done.
And although the committee, the discussion is fine on appropriation, it's going to finance. So that's where it'll stop for that discussion. Senator Dale.
Well, maybe for as an educational function, I'll pass this map around. It's for the North Fork of the Crow River. And if you look at the index here, it shows campsites, boat landings, place where you get drinking water and where there's dams and water access points and different things. And the river is all marked here according to the miles to the Minnesota River. And you can see all the things along the river that are marked here so you can see what's available. This is the North Fork of the Crow River that goes down to Mississippi.
Mississippi River.
We would welcome that, and we'd welcome you organizing some kind of new trip maybe later this year. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, have we acted on my motion?
We have not yet, Senator. It's still up for discussion. Any further discussion on the amendment? Adding the Section 2 with the appropriation. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 366 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Any further discussion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Thank you, Senator.
Chairman, thank you. And do you want us to take up the next bill for trail in our area?
You're in the chair. Go ahead. Senate File 365.
And I'll ask the other folks that are going to testify to come up and join me at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One, two, three, four, six.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 365 would add about a 35-mile loop to the Minnesota River Trail, and it would be a trail that would go from Redwood Falls to Sleepy Eye and then to Fort Ridgely State Park. I have given to committee staff letters of support from Redwood Falls, Sleepy Eye, Morgan, and Evan, I believe, and I will not distribute those to the rest of the committee, but the committee staff does have them indicating the support of those communities along this route. And that's also this project is part of an ongoing effort to have a trail system in the Minnesota River Valley, and specifically our interest is a trail system centered around Redwood Falls to Granite Falls and Sleepy Eye and New Ulm. There's been a very active group working on a number of issues, trails being one of them, called Tatanka Bluffs. It's viewed as recreation and fitness and health, but it's also viewed as economic development to have folks come to our part of the state to enjoy the beautiful Minnesota River. And there is one other part about this trail request. They have this designated as a trail. There is a likely route for siting this trail. It's an abandoned railroad right-of-way that is owned by one owner who is interested in cooperating with this effort. So there is land 100 feet wide and 26 miles long that we would hope would become the route for this trail. So, Mr. Chairman, with that as a background, I'll turn it over to the folks who came to testify. In the handout, the one that says Tatanka Bluffs, back about four sheets, there's a map that says Tatanka Trails, and the blue line on that map is the section that we are talking about. It goes from Redwood Falls to Sleepy Eye to Fort Ridgely State Park.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Julie Rath. I'm the Economic Development Specialist with the Redwood Area Development Corporation, and I am one of the facilitators in our group for Tatanka Bluffs. Tatanka Bluffs is a group that started about 18 months ago to identify ways that we could bring more people to our area and also provide recreational opportunities for our citizens. And as you go throughout the state and do bike, wherever trails have been designated, a lot of people come and use those trails, and consequently some even move to the area because the opportunity is there. We have three different goals in Tatanka Bluffs, and that's to increase the quality of life for our corridor citizens, to preserve the recreational resources and heritage of our corridor, and to create economic viability for our corridor. And that would be to attract enough critical citizens of childbearing age to replenish our school populations and to increase our population. The Tatanka Bluffs area is a joint partnership with Redwood and Renville County on both sides of the river. It goes from border to border of the counties from north to south and east to west. The first group that we're working with is the outdoor resource area, and that is connecting the resources that we have in the area. Renville County is well populated with five county parks along the Minnesota River. They could be used a lot more, and we would just like to increase the visibility of these parks and the access to them from the Minnesota River. The bike trail itself, I'm going to let Lauren go ahead and explain the trail part of this and how we've come to be where we are today.
Mr. Chairman, I am Lauren Cardall, and I am from Redwood Falls, and I'm Mr. Volunteer there. With this project, the vision was to look at a corridor or larger landmass and to see if they could put a system of interrelated trails together. And there's various trail groups in process and working. Of course, the Minnesota River Trail has been authorized, and as has the Casey Jones Trail, and we like to call it the Laura Ingalls Weiler extension from Walnut Grove into the Minnesota River Trail at Redwood Falls. With the availability of this land and the family willing to sell it, it just made absolute sense to make it into a trail rather than to bisect it back into five-acre pieces and sell it back to the adjoining farms. And it would connect and create a loop effect basically down to Sleepy Eye at this point in time and then back to Fort Ridgely. There is an existing trail from the city of Fairfax to the north, south to Fort Ridgely. From Fairfax north, there's a 31-mile gap to connect into the Loose Line Trail. And so within our vision, you would be able to leave the Minnetonka area within the next two decades and get down the Loose Line Trail and connect to the Fair Ridge Trail down south, and you actually could travel from the metro area to the Tatanka Bluffs Trail system on bike or by hiking. And so that is kind of the system in place. There's other trails that we would look at in the future, but the one today really is the Sleepy Eye Trail because of its immediate availability.
Questions? Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, are you planning on this being a limestone trail or a paved trail?
Actually, we were planning on a dual treadway, one paved and one crushed rock. We do have a significant horse population out there. I believe Redville County has more horses than people. And so there's two of the county parks specialize with horse trail riding, Skalbakken and Beaver Falls, as do the two state parks at the bookends of the corridor. Upper Sioux Agency State Park allows horses, as does Fort Ridgely.
So Mr. Chairman, sir, are you counting up, planning on the horses using the crushed rock?
Correct.
Because the Loose Line is limestone, but that's used by bicycles and other things, and there's a separate horse trail that is off from that.
We have not gotten into the details in terms of the specifics on the Chief Sleepy Eye Trail.
Mr. Chairman, to that question, we envision this being used for hard surface recreation, by horses, and also in winter for snowmobiles. The corridor is 100 feet wide.
Other questions? Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, will the snowmobilers be put on the horse trail, or can they travel on the paved surface?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, they would not be able to go on the paved surface. But there's enough right-of-way so they could have their own trail or own area. And perhaps it would I'm not sure how it aligned with the horse trail.
The current property owner loves horses and wants to see a horse trail there. The existing snowmobile trail does go from Redwood Falls to Evan at this point in time. I don't know if it's in the road right away or adjacent to it on this property along the course already. So that has been in existence at least a decade or more.
Mr. Chairman, we did have a couple more people that would like to testify. It appears to me that the committees have all ready to act.
Let's bring them in.
Bring.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tom Hollitz. I am a resident of Redwood Falls, but I'm also chairman of the Redwood Falls School Board. Our school looks at economic development to be almost vital for our area and especially for our schools. We also have a broader vision that tourism and offering amenities to the people in our area is important because it may attract businesses. And so to that end, we're very much in favor of this particular trail. Lauren alluded a little bit to all of the pieces of the puzzle that we have going on. And like any puzzle, when you begin to put it together, the most important piece is the first piece. And this is the first piece of the puzzle. And we are here today to ask for your support.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Martin Bodie. I am the Deputy Clerk Treasurer for the City of Morgan. In preparing for my testimony, I'd given some thought to putting together some fancy numbers and providing you a really impressive and dazzling presentation, but common sense prevailed.
Thank you.
However, having said that, I had planned on and providing an oral presentation on behalf of the community that I represent. But I received a call yesterday from Mr. Cardell asking me to, in particular, keep my comments brief. I'd only met him once previous, so I don't know what made him think I was long-winded. But keeping that in mind, I did, at short notice yesterday, ask the Mayor, Janelle Forbrook, for the City of Morgan, Robert Tews, Superintendent of Cedar Mountain Schools, and Wayne Weber, the President of the EDA, to please provide me with a testimony in writing. So it was rather a rapid response, so I apologize for some of them not appearing as professional as I would have liked them to be. On a personal note, please allow me to express my overwhelming support for this project. You see, a number of years ago, as a matter of fact, 4 years ago, for health reasons, I took up running as an exercise, and I say quite proudly today, I call myself a runner, and I am pleased to be part of that type of organization of people. In the times that we do live in today, the state of Minnesota, the taxpayers, we spend a great deal of money on crime and the results of crime due to law enforcement, crime prevention, long and short-term jail. It's a rather expensive pursuit for the state, and I think this would be just an awesome opportunity for the state of Minnesota to support a project that promotes family, health, well-being, and recreation. And it may not be the most appropriate term to use, but I'm looking forward to the trail being completed for the simple reason it would be fun to run on. And I thank you in advance for your favorable support of this project, and I thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Questions? Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll volunteer to run with Mr. Bodie. And I would move that Senate File 365 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, there was so much to look at here that I may have missed if you had had said this. It is. I heard you say that there's private land that is being either donated or open to acquisition for the trail. This is not an abandoned rail bed then? Is it all a path through private land?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you're right on both accounts. This is private land, and it's all owned by one family.
Really? Great.
Name you'd recommend, Mathewitz. It was a railroad. It was abandoned, and Mathewitz Construction bought it, removed the roadbed, removed the rails, and returned it to farmland. But Richard Mathewitz's original purpose was to turn it into a trail, and back 30 years ago, nobody was interested. Now there's interest.
Senator Frederickson, in regards to your motion, we'd like to leave that as possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Could it dual track?
It's up to Senator Chaudhry, I don't know.
That would be up to Senator Chaudhry. As he was leaving, he asked that this is where it goes.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, that would be fine with me, and we can have a
future conversation and perhaps decide to...
There's a department bill with trails in it already, too.
And there is a department bill that trails it as well.
That's fine. Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate file 365 be recommended to pass and then laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus trail bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Senator. Thank you to those who testified. Senate file 617. Senator Kubley here. Okay, we're going to check. He might be out in the hall. Good afternoon, Senator Kubley. You're up. Committee, we're turning to Senate file 617 and Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate file 617 deals with the designation of a segment of trail between Granite Falls and Wegdahl, which is, you know, hooks up with the trail that goes from Wegdahl to Montevideo. And it does seem to me that it needs to be designated as a state trail so that money that has already been appropriated can be used to acquire the land along there. There's been really a great deal of local support on this segment, and it's really, in my understanding, it's the only segment of the trail that's really ready to go. There have been a number of items completed. There's been a preliminary environmental review by the Department of Natural Resources. There was a phase one of an environmental report there with a detailed digital survey that was plus or minus a foot in accuracy on the space that would be needed. There has been a topographical survey that has been completed. MnDOT has done a draft of a project memorandum. There are good estimates, I think, on the costs of three areas, final engineering, development, and construction. And there's really only one parcel of land that is held by individuals. The rest of it is owned by the railroad. The railroad has been opposed. They've traditionally been opposed to trails that go along rails. They say they're supportive, but sometimes I wonder about that. But they're here, and they can make their own case. They are appealing the eminent domain proceeding that they lost, Mr. Chair, and I think the appeal is just a delay tactic, but they have a different opinion. So I'm sure you'll hear from them as well.
Questions for Senator Kubley? Any others who would like to testify for or against? Please identify yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I'm here representing the Twin Cities and Western Railroad. And I ain't making any friends sitting here. I know that for a fact. So it's good to see you all. I have every respect for Senator Kubley, and we got a great deal of hope that this trail goes through, that you guys find the money to build the Minnesota River Trail. It's a great asset out in western Minnesota, And we were here yesterday to advocate, although some thought we weren't, but to advocate on behalf of a House bill that would move a portion of this trail forward. We've worked with various different towns and communities along the line, the Twin Cities and Western has, where we've had relationships. Appleton is the one in particular. But it's no secret that the issue that we have a concern about, the Twin Cities and Western has a concern about, is placing a trail, a bike trail, close to and adjacent to and along the trail or along our railroad tracks that run essentially from Wigdall down to Granite Falls. This is essentially the portion of the trail that we're talking about here. There's three possible options, as I understand it, out there. One of the options is to run adjacent to the railroad track. It is the most beautiful option, if you will, because it's closest to the river. And clearly that's one of the reasons why the good folks in that area would want to run along here. But it is an operating railroad. We run trains down these tracks. We've got locomotives and other sorts of rail equipment that run down these tracks. And granted, it's a couple trains a day, and it will be about four trains a day as we begin to do some other movements out in the western part of the state. But there are trains running down these tracks. One of the rejoinders might be, well, gosh, you only got four trains running down the track. What's the big deal? That's the big deal. The less trains running down a railroad track, quite often, the more dangerous it is because of the fact that people aren't paying attention and watching for that big old locomotive coming down the road. You might say, why do we oppose this route? The very basic issue here is that people and trains don't mix well. When people and trains mix, people come away the losers. They lose arms, they lose legs, they lose lives. And as an industry, and as a railroad in this instance, we are simply opposed to the idea of putting pedestrians together with rail track. Senator Kubley is correct. The city of Granite Falls has initiated an eminent domain proceeding against the railroad to acquire an easement along our track and to lay in the trail along the track. It's within 50 feet of the center line, typically the center line of the rail track, so you can kind of measure that in terms of the distance of the room, I think. And there would have to be some significant improvements made along the track. I can give you some pictures and stuff, which I won't get into, but significant improvements that have to be made to make sure that that trail works. But it's going to be close to the tracks. And people have a propensity to get on railroad tracks. It's an issue that we try to avoid at all possible costs. I lay it out here because you need to hear this. The DNR needs to hear this. People who are going to fund this need to hear this. And our basic premise is that rails and trails side by side simply don't mix. Yes, there are trails elsewhere. There are trails in the city of Minneapolis, right next to railroad tracks. Some of you probably walked up and down them. But let me tell you about the trail that goes through Kenilworth. That used to be a railroad track. And then the railroad was abandoned through there, and the railroad ran along the 29th Street corridor. When it ran along the 29th Street corridor, excuse me, that's me, and I apologize. We were separated. The trail going through Kenilworth, going through Kenwood, was turned into a trail. That railroad track. What happened was the 29th Street corridor was cut off when the Hiawatha line was put in, so we had to, the TC&W, had to go back on the Kenilworth trail, on the Kenilworth track. Indeed, there is a trail next to the track. That's absolutely right. And that's the reason why. It was a train track. It was abandoned. It turned into a trail. The alternative was cut off, and the train track had to go back to where the trail is. That isn't the way we'd prefer it to be. It's the way it had to be. It isn't the way you design a trail relationship with the track, and that's the concern we want to issue today. We have the greatest respect for the gentleman to my right. We pledged to work with him to figure out a way to make this trail come to fruition. We want to see it happen, and we just want to plead the case for not putting it on a railroad track bed. sufficient said.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Again, with due respect to Mr. Appetz, you know, there are all kinds of examples. I'm sure that you, as I do, you know, we got a magazine called Rails and Trails. Some of those rails and trails were planned that way from the beginning. You know, there are other examples of trails in Minnesota where the trains have a speed of 60 miles an hour. This segment of track, they have a speed, well, they are permitted for up to 40 miles an hour, but they do not travel over 30 miles an hour. So I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, the railroad is raising these barriers to simply try and delay the project. You know, they're aware of those things, and, you know, they, it seems to me that they raise them in the hopes of, you know, getting their way on something that, you know, is just going to draw out the legal proceedings and cost considerably more than we had intended in the first place. And, you know, it's our intent to save the dollars that we can. I think it will be decided in favor of the trail right down through the court system, regardless of how far the railroad chooses to pursue it, but that the court will find in favor of the city regardless of how far those appeals are taken.
Senator Olson had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and when Mr. Appetz or Senator Kubley, when trails are adjacent to railroads, is there a barrier? You talked about raising barriers. Is there a barrier? Is there any kind of fencing or division or, you know, or in combination with plantings that provide a separation between the rail and the trail?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, you know, and I appreciated the fact that the railroad offered me a ride along the trail location, and there is some distance. I mean, they're saying less than 50 feet, and that's true. But it does seem to me that there's adequate space in between there that the likelihood of an accident is really pretty minimal. You know, you'd almost have to intentionally run toward the rail in many of those places. And, you know, there are some engineering feats that need to be accomplished along that route. But, you know, I think most of them can be done. You know, we have trails in other parts of the state that have encountered the same kinds of things, so I don't think that there's anything here that ought to delay it any further. You know, it's been delayed for quite a while already.
Mr. Chairman, it seems that in many cases when trails are about to be put in, that there's a lot of great fear of what, you know, the folks who are on those trails, if they're going to enter private property or break into homes or all kinds of things. We were having that with the Dakota Rail. It's a beautiful line that's going to come out from Wayzata and continue on ultimately to Hutchinson. It is another route besides the Loose Line, which is right nearby, too. And, you know, great apprehension. But it seems to me that when trails get put in place, people tend to stay on the trail unless there's some specific place that is intended to attract them off. Hopefully the Minnetonka drive-in for nice cold root beer along the Dakota Rail. But, you know, that type of thing, rather than whether people are going to be, I don't know if others could attest to it, as to how great that possibility is that people would actually want to leave a trail and go over on a railroad track.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, you know, that I agree. It doesn't seem very high to me, and I understand the fears that are there. It does seem to me that the people who use trails are not the kinds of folks who are going to be trespassing on private property or any of those issues. There's really only one couple who owns some of the land along there, and the rest of it does belong to the railroad. You know, I think in a sense, I mean, I can understand the railroad's concern. You know, they don't want anything to happen. But Minnesota also has a statute that relieves a private entity like a railroad of any liability if they give a permanent easement to a recreational use. So I'm not sure, you know, the source of that. Mr. Appetz is an attorney. Maybe he could address that further. But you know, from my perspective, it seems to me that even the opponents of trails, that once the trails are established, many of the opponents become supporters of those trails. So I think trails have a lot to recommend them to us as a legislative body and to the members of the public at large. But I think, you know, Mr. Appitz has already agreed that there are examples that, you know, the fears, and I think the fear is probably our biggest barrier to getting this job done. But, you know, those fears, it's highly unlikely that they will ever be realized.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was probably answered about the liability if the state of Minnesota would actually, or not the state of Minnesota, but the authority of the trail would release the liability of the train company should something happen.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's my understanding that state statute, relieves the entity that gives the easement of any liability for that recreational purpose.
Mr. Appitz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley is correct in that regard. The statute that we're talking about in particular came about 10 years ago when snowmobile clubs were seeking to be able to cross railroad tracks, and we didn't like that idea a lot. One of the problems with snowmobiles is you can't hear, and a lot of snowmobilers at the time were kind of enjoying the opportunity of running down the track, and they'd cross over, and we'd meet them, and they wouldn't be in too good a shape after we were done with the conversation. And so a law was created to allow snowmobilers to be able to run down certain track if liability is waived, if various paths are maintained by the local snowmobile clubs. I am not certain, and I'll apologize. Judy may know how that applies, how that would apply in the instance of trails. I bet you Judy does know. Please, why don't you, to that point, and then I'll just...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Judy Erickson with the Parks and Trails Council. In about 1995, we worked with MinUSA to get liability exemptions for landowners who allowed trails on private property. And part of the reason was, as Mr. Appitz indicated, but another reason was that some of the larger timber companies in northern Minnesota who are now being owned by people out east were concerned about these trails as well. So that liability protection is extended to the landowner who allows a trail on their property.
Just follow up. Are you comfortable with that liability, release of liability?
We are typically sued under the federal, under FELA, which is a federal law. And essentially, this is an overstatement, but the way that law works is if the railroad sued, the railroad's liable. There ain't a whole lot of argument about it. We end up paying for damages in a host of different situations. It's a little bit of an overstatement, but it's one of the major concerns we have. We typically get sued under other law than state law. We get sued under federal law.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I could just briefly to rejoin. And I'm not here to ask for any sort of changes in Senator Kubley's bill, but there are three routes here. There are two other routes. This is potentially the most attractive one, obviously. This is the only one that involves one landowner other than ourselves, and so it makes it easier to do this. Certainly, condemnation proceedings have been brought against us. And the court said, yeah, go ahead. We'll see how that all works out because we appealed that matter last Thursday. And given what you all did last year with the eminent domain laws, I'm not certain that necessarily will come out in favor of the landowners. But we'll see how that turns out. We do have a concern that it's only once that you run over somebody. It's only once. It only takes once. It's not like you get hurt. It's like you get killed. And that's what we're trying to prevent. There would be fencing, yes, indeed. There would be fencing along a portion of this. There'd have to be because it will come close to the tracks in some instances, just given the terrain out there. But I want to emphasize one more time, we'd want to see the Minnesota River Trail developed. It is a great asset for Western Minnesota. We encourage you to put some funding into it. We're working with people along the line. We're not trying to obstruct this. This section is a concern to us.
If there's no further discussion, Senate File 617 will be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Cooley. Okay. Senate File 642. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if someone would be so kind, I do have the A1 and author's amendment that I'd like to add to the bill to get the bill in the shape the author would prefer.
Senator Stump will move that. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 642, a ditch buffer strip and drainage bill. In 2005, the Minnesota legislature directed the Board of Water and Soil Resources to conduct an assessment of the use, maintenance, and benefits of required grass strips along public drainage ditches in consultation with the stakeholders. That effort produced the Public Drainage Ditch Buffer Study in February of 2006. The drainage work group is an outgrowth of that study. And today we're here to present Senate File Number 642, which reflects the recommendations of the drainage work group that was established by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Mr. Chair, I do have for you many letters of support. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, the Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Farmers Union, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, Minnesota Viewers Association, Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance, Minnesota Farm Bureau, and finally the Minnesota Conservation Federation. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Doug Thomas, the Assistant Director of Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, who will walk you through the bill. And after that, Harlan Mattson would also like to discuss the bill with you, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. If I could, I'd like to direct your attention to two things that you should have had in your packet. One of them is titled Drainage Work Group Fact Sheet, and another one is says Bill Overview on the top. And I'll try to reference those to help walk through the bill for you today. As Senator Sparks mentioned, we've been at this effort for 2 years, and if you look at the back side of the Drainage Work Group fact sheet, I'd like to draw your attention to the full membership of the work group. Again, we've spent a lot of time trying to come to developing a set of consensus recommendations, understanding some of the views and perspectives that have existed over time regarding the drainage law, and recognizing if we're going to get things done, we have to do that in cooperation with folks. The other part on there is there's two diagrams. Those diagrams are really what began our discussion 2 years ago, and that was how are people determining the point of beginning for how you measure the grass buffer strip when you have a project that is part of a public drainage system? And what we basically came up to was on the top sheet, where you have a proceeding that involves the moving of dirt, a new ditch being constructed, an improvement to a ditch, or a major repair, and where that requires the appointment of viewers. We basically have come to an agreement, and the language is reflected in the bill, that the top edge of the ditch is now defined by what is called the top edge of the constructed channel resulting from the proceedings. So it's the proceeding that drives the determination, and when you go out in there in the field where you have a leveled spoil bank, that point of beginning is where you see it on the left side of that drawing on the top half. And if that spoil is ditch spoil bank is not leveled, you go to the top of that continuous slope and you measure your 16.5 feet out from that point. The other distinction that we made is where you have a ditch buffers being required to be established where there is no moving of dirt. There are a number of situations where you can have just simply a redetermination of benefits and damages, which is nothing more than people going out, viewers going out to that public drainage system and assessing what the current benefits that are for the properties and what damages there would be for creating the grass buffer strip. And in this case, it limits the width of the strip to 16.5 feet from those two top edges that are shown in the drawing. And I think those are kind of critical drawings because it's really what we spent the bulk of our time for 2 years wrestling with, is trying to come up with how to clarify that point and then how you consistently measure and implement that required grass buffer strip for those proceedings which do that. So with that, I'd like to switch over to just walking you quickly through the bill. Subdivision Section 1 of the bill basically changes it's a relatively simple change, but it's an important change. Right now, the current law says grass strips, and we know of a number of situations where we're wanting to promote the use of native vegetation, which includes grasses and forbs, for example. Parts of northeastern Minnesota where the native vegetation, the perennial vegetation, is not grass. It's areas that are going through forested areas or areas of significant wetlands. And this change to perennial vegetation kind of makes it clear that the drainage authority can determine what that is rather than potentially having a situation where somebody might have to go in and cut down 16.5 feet of trees on one side of a ditch project where it's being improved simply because the law says you have to plant grass. So that's what that change accomplishes. The other thing is that the amendment that you adopted, the A1 amendment, would include adding to that section that preference should be given to planting of native species of a local ecotype. And that's an acknowledgement that as we move forward, that preference should be given to the use of native plants in that 16.5 foot buffer strip. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill are simply conforming changes, which replace grass with the terms perennial vegetation. Section 4 of the bill is probably one of the more significant pieces in that it is a new subdivision that would be added to the drainage law, which provides for incremental implementation of the buffer strip and site inlet controls, which are erosion control practices. Currently, the law requires a drainage authority to go through a fairly laborious, full-blown determination of benefits and damages, which has been estimated by people that could cost up to $100,000 just to simply do that, and that's not even moving a spoonful of dirt on those projects. What this provision does is allows the drainage authority, where they determine that grass buffer strips are beneficial for purposes of water quality or maintaining the efficiency, in other words, for maintenance, future maintenance of that ditch, it allows them to go through a process where they only have to determine damages, which are paid to the landowner when that grass strip is acquired, and it requires them to go through the same kind of public notice and due process that other ditch proceedings do in the drainage law. So it does not expedite or take away any due process for citizens or landowners along the public drainage system. Section 6 is, and at that point then, if you're following along in the bill, Section 5 is there's a new Section 5 which the amendment creates, which is some fairly simple and straightforward annual reporting that would have to be done by public drainage authorities to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And a lot of the goal there is, we've heard a lot this year the word transparency being used, and this is really a way for a lot of those activities so that we don't have to go back and do this kind of a study every 5 to 10 years, a way to get some information back on an annual basis without great cost to the drainage authorities to provide information and have that available back to the legislature and others that may have an interest in those public drainage systems.
Mr. Thomas, could yes. you explain to us what or who the drainage authority would be?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Drainage authorities basically are two entities in the state of Minnesota. It's either counties or watershed districts who are considered to be the public drainage authorities. Basically, those systems are private systems. All of the costs are borne by the benefited landowners, but the counties or the watershed district, and the law determines which one that is, have a fiduciary responsibility to inspect, operate, maintain, and assure that that drainage system is being managed in a way that's providing those benefits back to those landowners. So they could actually. Moving on, then the rest of the bill. Then the numbers change because of the amendment. So section 5 becomes section 6 of the bill, and the new section 6 is a provision which clarifies that damages can be paid and can be determined by a drainage authority for conservation practices that are damaged at the time of a repair and improvement or a new drainage system being built. The point there is we've got over 1,700 miles of buffers along drainage systems that are installed as part of federal or state conservation programs that you're familiar maybe with are CRP, the RIM program on the state side. We've had some attorneys basically have said that the drainage authority does not have an obligation to repair damages if spoil is taken out of the ditch placed on that conservation land. That actually makes that landowner in violation of either their CRP contract or their RIM contract. And we've had attorneys representing drainage authorities saying they're not responsible for that recreating or replacing the vegetation. This would clarify that that is their responsibility and that they can determine and pay damages for that purpose. Section 7 of the bill is again simply a conforming change replacing grass with perennial vegetation. The Section 8 of the bill, which again is old Section 7, is again clarification that makes sure that drainage authorities are again required to pay for that restoring of the conservation practice that would be damaged by a drainage system repair. And then Section 9 of the bill is a bill that clarifies on the required inspection of drainage systems that inspection system, although it's required to be regularly inspected, specifies that it has to be at least once every 5 years. And if there's a violation of the buffer strip found, that has to be inspected annually until that violation is corrected by the landowner or by the drainage authority. Section 10 of the bill is basically sections 10 and 11 are simply, again, conforming changes. And then section 13 is the appropriations language, and basically what the bill does is appropriates money, $2 million for cost share assistance to drainage authorities to undertake records modernization, $150,000 to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to develop the records preservation and modernization guidelines so that we have some uniformity in how those are being done. $300,000 to update the state's drainage manual, and then open appropriations for continuing the efforts of the drainage work group and the creation of a state drainage assistance team. I do want to point out in the overview that we provided you is that in the Bowser budget, the governor is recommending $150,000 in the first year of the biennium for the development of those records preservation and modernization guidelines, $500,000 in the second year for the providing cost share to drainage authorities for modernization of drainage records, and then $300,000 in 2008-2009 to create the drainage assistance team and to update the public drainage manual as part of that funding. So with that, that's hopefully a quick overview for you of the components of the bill.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you look at the membership of the drainage work group, it seems like one of the obvious units that's missing are the townships. I'm wondering if they, if you had input from the townships. I know I see counties, but not actually the townships.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, we did not exclude anybody from participating in the townships. I believe attended one of the work group meetings. They were not included specifically in terms of our target because, again, they are not a public drainage authority. They themselves, you know, although they have road ditches and they may have parts of it that are associated with the public drainage system, they themselves are not public drainage authorities.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I mention that is that in my area of the state, there's a lot of township roads that actually are public roads that are created by the spoil banks from the drainage system. And so I'm not sure how this kind of networks together. And I presume there's some kind of a grandfathering in, because if you took the 16.5 feet, you'd be in the middle of the road in some cases.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, I did not include a third drawing in the information that you have, but the drainage law and the drainage manual are very clear about how you deal with a public drainage system that parallels a public road. And basically the requirement there is that the side slope of the road and the side slope of the ditch have to be vegetated. But again, there's no requirement that you'd have to go 16.5 feet, you know, into the road itself. So that is clearly laid out in statute how that situation is handled.
Thank you.
Mr. Madsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Harlan Madsen, County Commissioner from Kandy High County. I'd like to just give you a little background, if I may. I'm in my fourth term as a county commissioner, my fourth decade as a dairy farmer. I served as an agriculture instructor and FFA advisor for 4 years. We're supposed to get 4 inches of snow tonight, tomorrow, and the next day, and I start chores at 4 o'clock. So with that, I have 2 hours of travel time before I move home, and I do appreciate the opportunity to be here. If I may, Mr. Chairman, just a little background. I've been a member of the Drainage Work Group for the last 2 years. I started as a member of the work group as I was president of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we wanted to be participating and be at the table. The Drainage Work Group, as you see by the diversity there, really was very polarized to start with. We had the far right and the far left, and a number of groups in the middle. What took place over the last 2 years is that we had a transition, we had an education, we had a learning curve that was very steep for all of us. As a result of that, at the end of 2 years, we now have relationships, we now have understanding, we now have trust. Do we have different philosophies? Absolutely. Do we have some different political agendas and different items we deal with? Absolutely. But we coalesced on, what do we want as an outcome from this particular group? Do we want cleaner water? Do we want reduced ditch maintenance? Do we want buffer strips established? Do we want to identify the impediments that are there? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. And the list goes on. We started with a seemingly, in verbiage, a very simple charge that said, look at buffers and look at enforcements and those types of things. We soon came to a realization after about 2 minutes at the first meeting that we are looking at a very complicated, very convoluted, and very controversial issues. As the result of that, we put our, and I mean we as a group, put our heads together and looked at what we could do incrementally to provide improvement, emendations, deletions, and so on and so forth to a drainage code which is, in some situations, sacred. Individuals that really don't want to touch these things. We agreed that we would discuss and proceed by consensus. We would all be heard, and we would all look at how we get to our objective, and that is providing those clean water initiatives and so on and so forth. The first meeting, you could identify at the table which group you were there because we sat apart from each other. The last meeting of these 2 years,
We intermingled. You could not identify. You could not label. And at the breaks, we all interacted and we dialogued. We came to an understanding. I think that is the most important aspect in dealing with whether it's this legislation or any kind of legislation, is building those understandings and those trusts and establishing and agreeing upon and moving towards a goal. I wanted to tell you that because I wanted to say thank you for any role that you played in providing the charge and getting this to happen, because this bill, while not perfect, while not solving everything, makes some huge steps to empowering, to providing local flexibility, to demanding of us as ditch authorities that we do the job, that we are able to be tailoring to the local, but that we move ahead with some very positive objectives in that situation. We identified numerous things, and many of these are addressed in there. We also identified that as a group and as a community and as a state, we need to continue that dialogue, so we're moving ahead, and you see the part of that in the bill as well. I want to clearly identify one example and piggyback from what Mr. Thomas said with the CRP. One of the things that we came to a strong realization about is the impediments. I am a farmer. I have 7 miles of buffer strips that is on our farm, on the 100-acre or 1,000 acres that my son and I operate with 100 dairy cows. We have 7 miles. It takes up about 17 acres of land. Why did I do it? Number one, it's the right thing to do. Number two, as a member of a drainage authority, I don't believe that I can advocate for something unless I'm prepared and willing to do it myself. So I put the buffer strips in there. It gives up some land, absolutely. But what it does, it substantially reduces the ditch maintenance. It reduces sedimentation, TSS, and everything that we deal with, TMDLs and the rest. With the court case from 1957, if I recall, Doug, which CRP wasn't even cardiac pulmonary resuscitation at that point. It certainly was not the Conservation Reserve Program. We didn't know about it at that point in time. But the court case says that the spoils that were placed on that particular individual's property were not, the restoration was not the responsibility of the ditch authority. It is probably the single biggest impediment we have to establishing CRP, because in some of the CRP plans that are put forth, we can spend $500 to $600 to $700 an acre if the certain forbs and certain vegetation are there. I put mine in, it was about $175 an acre. If I, as a landowner, am charged with the total restoration cost for that, and I'm going to do that when the ditch is cleaned, that is an impediment and a disservice to, I think, the public. By changing that one single thing makes a world of difference in terms of our state. The second thing is we discovered that a very convoluted process between the state and the federal and the local. Many of the rules overlap, supersede, eliminate, reverse the decisions that landowners are going to make. The rules work against each other. Significant time was spent trying to work with the various agencies so that, again, we try to say, what can each of us do to get the job done? What can each of us do to establish buffer strips incrementally and move ahead in terms of water quality? Those are some of the next steps that we need to work at. Also looking at providing habitat, the possibility in this legislation and existing 103E is to allow for harvesting of the buffer strips. From a livestock standpoint, Senator Dill, harvesting those buffer strips might be very good from a livestock standpoint. It is the best thing we can do in terms of viability and strength of that vegetation is to provide periodic harvest. I don't want to have the fires going up and down, and as we well know, that's one of the things is controlled burns. I have yet to see very successful controlled burns in the dry area in rural Minnesota, and I don't want to start with that. This legislation accomplishes some of those things. With that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time. And again, I want to emphasize, this is a major step of clarification, consistency, interpretation, enforcement. It empowers, it engages, it demands that we as local ditch authorities do the job, but it provides those incentives as far as moving ahead. And I look forward to more opportunities as a DWG member to continue discussing and making improvements within our area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, and let's see, what is the, Mr. Madsen, does Do the perennial plantings on these buffer strips have any potential for being harvested for the future basis for ethanol, these the perennial grasses that they're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the answer would be yes. It is one of the considerations that we looked at, whether it be switchgrass, whether it be the cellulistic fibers. Those are the potentials. A lot of the challenges result and rest with the local authorities then to tailor those particular needs. But the answer, the simple answer is yes.
Maybe even more importantly, these can really serve the purpose of the much-needed seed banks that we need for that cellulosic. We've got a real issue with that, and this could really be the source of those native seeds that we're going to need in thousands of acres worth once cellulosic gets up and going.
Mr. Chairman, if these are much of them are in private land, so this could be a source of income to those folks too.
Senator Stumpf.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions on the discussion of the inspection, the annual or the five-year inspection. Was there some discussion about some of the larger watershed districts that how that might be able to be carried out? Can that be done by air, or does that need to be walked, or can you use a Arctic Cat ATV, or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, we don't specify, nor does 103E specify how the inspection is done. It could be aerial, it could be by ATV, as you suggested, or it could be by walking.
Was there discussion in your group about, and I'm just looking at the permanent vegetative cover, if a property owner does not comply, that the watershed district then has the responsibility to go ahead and or do the work, and then the charge would be billed back to the property owner. Is that hold true for the state of Minnesota too?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, that would hold true in the sense that if a public drainage system was constructed and the entity was paid damages for the required grass buffer strip, that the drainage authority, to be my understanding, would have the ability to enforce the requirement that that grass, or that in this case now the perennial vegetative buffer strip, is there and is preserved. What's growing on there is now of much more discretion to the drainage authority.
So, Mr. Chairman, the cost then would be billed back to the state for their portion or their share. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, and that is the question, and I think where you're going is the situation that exists in northwestern Minnesota with a number of counties on the designation of consolidated conservation lands and the one-time payments that the state made to the drainage authorities, then with the stipulation that they're not going to pay any more benefits until the counties or the drainage authorities go through a redetermination of benefits and damages on those systems. That issue was brought to the work group. Obviously, we didn't feel we had time in this last year to wrestle and try to have that kind of dialogue about criteria and how that redetermination of benefits is done, because in some respects it's described by people as a catch-22. Because DNR still has the ultimate authority to say yes or no to the redetermination of benefits or damages on those properties. That's one of the items that the work group has actually said we're willing to talk about. DNR has said we're willing to come to the table and have that discussion. I think that's one of the values of the bill and the continuation of this kind of a group is to wrestle with those things, as well as some of the urban issues, urban abandonment, and a number of other things that people are raising as issues that they have.
So I guess, Mr. Chairman, the question is, what control does the local drainage authority have over public land? There's a slope on a ditch that is eroding, and you go and the local drainage authority, it's public land, and you see that and you want the want to fix that, basically, because it's eroding into the river or drip ditch. What force do you have as a local drainage authority to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, again, it goes back to the drainage authority having jurisdiction to, one, inspect, make sure that the efficiency of the system is maintained, and to order the necessary repairs. And that would be something probably short of a major repair, but it would be something considered a minor repair, an obstruction removal. They have the authority to go in and enter upon any land that that ditch crosses over, because that's the easement, in fact, that they own, or that they have the right of entry on to do that work. Question, I think, comes back to then the payment of it. And right now, payment of those kinds of repairs come out of a ditch maintenance fund. The ditch maintenance fund is funded by ad valorem levies back to the benefited properties in that percent that they were determined to benefit by in the original proceedings. And that's where, again, we run into some of the conflicts that you're describing in Northwest Minnesota, where those public lands are not necessarily paying that same annual maintenance or that maintenance fee that might be charged back to the benefited properties on a reoccurring basis.
Mr. Chairman, one final question. Do you think that this vegetative cover, if planted, should be maintained in such a way that the weeds and quality of that vegetative cover should be, the integrity of that vegetative cover should be maintained?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, I think the answer, I think, lies probably more with the individual drainage authorities and their determination of what they believe is adequate, perennial vegetation when that grass buffer strip is required. The inside part of the ditch has obviously maintenance issues there as well. So I guess, is there value in regular maintenance of it? Yeah, I think Commissioner Manson answered that, at least in ag areas, where, yes, there is, because of the additional water quality benefits, making sure that we have a vigorous, vegetation out there so that we're reducing kind of the potential for sloughing and a number of those other things. That's part of that inspection that takes place, is if the drainage authority identifies areas where that vegetation is not being properly maintained or, in fact, is encroached upon or gone, they're really required by law. And I think what we're proposing in the bill gets us being a lot more proactive in making sure that, one, those inspections get done on a regular basis, at least once every 5 years, and then where problems are found, that they're actually followed up on and corrected.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, the point I was trying to get at is that sometimes we have double standards, where we have a standard for private land or we have standards for ag land. Then when we come back to the state land, it's a total different standard. And whether it's, noxious weeds or whether it's the slope of a ditch or whether it's who pays for it, that standard, I think, ought to be the same across the board, because if we're going to pass a law that requires a certain slope or a certain kind of or a certain quality of vegetative cover, I think we ought to, as a state, whether it's state land or private land, we ought to live up to that.
Further discussion on Senate File 642. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment I'd like to make.
Go ahead.
In one section, it's on page 1, line 20. As I read that, I found it rather confusing, the phrase "construct a channel resulting from the proceeding." So I would move on line 20, delete "resulting from" and insert "as established by."
Thomas?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, I'm very reluctant to look at different language. This language is, again, we've worked on for over 2 years. We've had some of the top drainage attorneys in the state of Minnesota working with us, and that issue of defining it from the proceedings is very critical to making sure that, because the proceedings can be many different things, and one of the problems we were running into is people going out and saying, well, the ditch was constructed in 1950, and it's eroded back 3 or 4 feet, so the point to begin is actually out in the middle of the air. And what we're trying to make sure is that by using the term from the proceeding, it's the proceeding that is taking place at that time. It could be a repair proceeding, an improvement proceeding, and the proceeding is a term used in drainage law to talk about that those actions being taken by a drainage authority. And so I guess I'm reluctant on one is making sure that we are not, you know, inherently causing a different interpretation down the road to be made from what we've got agreement on. And again, have had some of the state's top drainage attorneys, you know, that participated with us to come up with the language there. That was one of the more difficult challenges that we had. And so I just would urge great caution in any change to that.
So resulting from the proceeding is a term of art in...
Right, because proceeding is defined in... Yes.
Mr. Chairman, he's not...
Mr. Chairman?
He's not changing proceeding.
Mr. Thomas, I'm not changing proceeding. But what I am struggling with to understand is what is resulting from the proceeding. And I would delete resulting from and say established by the proceeding. So the top edge of the constructed channel would be established by the proceeding.
As established, you said.
As established by the proceeding.
Mr. Thomas, do you have any of your...
I'm going to ask our chief engineer, Mr. Al Kane, because I think in part, if you look at the whole sentence, I think it does make some sense.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I'm Al Kane, chief engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I think what Doug is trying to allude to is the fact that in the debate amongst the drainage work group about that language, trying to use words that didn't imply other things that those words imply in drainage law. The word established implies then establishment, which is the implementation of a new ditch, establishment of a new ditch. Whereas one of the things that a proceeding can do is a major repair. So repair can also be a proceeding for which then there is a new top of the channel bank resulting, and therefore I think that language was used resulting from to be more neutral relative to the existing ditch law language.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Al Kane.
Mr. Kane, the way this is worded now, what is going to result from the proceeding in this phrase?
A new top of the channel bank, Senator.
So, Mr. Kane, you're establishing the top edge of the constructed channel. So why can't we say that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there is again that implication of an establishment of a ditch when in fact this applies to several types of proceedings, one of which is establishment, one is improvement, and one is a major repair. So all three of those types of proceedings this applies to, and I think the drainage work group felt this language better applied to all of those types of proceedings.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kane, under all three of those, I think you're establishing the top edge of the channel. I'm still not convinced that
you are.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I appreciate it is a matter just of how we want to interpret those words. I believe that, again, we're trying to be very careful that we stay with the consensus language of the drainage work group.
Just
Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf has showed me the definitions in our statute, including definition of drainage project and established. I would pursue my amendment.
Okay. All right, further discussion on the Fredrickson Amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
What does established mean in the statute?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, established means the Drainage Authority has made the order to construct the drainage project. And then you have to, there's a lot of definitions in the Drainage Code. And then there's actually a definition of drainage project. Drainage project means a new drainage system, an improvement of a drainage system, an improvement of an outlet or a lateral. In fact, proceeding is also, I think, defined too. Yeah.
Hey, Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just in reference to the amendment, back in my district, this is a huge thing about where that ditch starts and stops and how we're going to cover it up. I'm going to just, Senator Fredrickson, trust that these guys put the words together for a reason.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I certainly understand your position. My intent is to have the law say exactly what it is we want to happen or not happen, and to say it so it's well-phrased and understandable.
I appreciate
and
that.
And I have no intent, just so it's clear, I have no intent of changing the intent of this provision. In my view, it's a technical phrasing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Madsen, make a comment, please.
Mr. Madsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, this was one of the most convoluted, controversial, complicated discussions that we have. It is seemingly very simple, and I respect Senator Fredrickson's concerns in trying to bring clarity and simplification to a very complex law, but I will assure you that this was treated very seriously. It was researched. It was debated on a number of different occasions, and frankly, this language fits to my belief, representing the committee, the best intent, and it really hones in. We have everything level between the House and the Senate, and I'm afraid that by even minor tweaking, we can have reverberations and ramifications that some attorney, with no disrespect, please, that some attorney will cite a case or cite some exclusion. And I think, Mr. Thomas, we had those numbers of discussions at the Drainage Work Group. And this is, I believe, the best language at this point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Fredrickson, sounds like there's growing heartburn.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Madsen, and concurring with your intent not to disparage the legal community, I think there is more chance for ambiguity with the existing law than with the existing language than with my amendment. My amendment is much more precise. It uses terms that are established in the definition portion of that section of statute. I think there would be less opportunity for learned attorneys to disagree with the way
Mr. Chair,
okay,
final word on the author, then we'll vote on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, and if I may, just to Senator Fredrickson, obviously I respect him, and he's been a longtime member of this committee. This bill will have a couple more stops in Senator Vickerman's and Senator Anderson's committee. I would certainly be willing to work with Senator Fredrickson, but I think, as you can hear, I would hate to blow up a lot of the work that this group did. However, I would promise Senator Fredrickson I would continue to work with him if he's amenable to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would pursue my amendment, and I would commit, if it is adopted, to work with Senator Sparks and the other.
Right. On the Fredrickson Amendment, further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No. Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 642. Seeing none. Someone like to make a motion? Senator Anderson will move that Senate File 642 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture.
And Veterans.
Agriculture and Veterans. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Paraso, can we handle your bill to the next committee?
I'd be at the end of the agenda again.
We'll put you first.
Thank you. I had my witnesses here today. But that's
well, they were, Senator, I'm noticing that they were from the department. That's the only reason.
They are, but there's also one other one, but that's okay.
Another.
As long as
Senator,
I get
Senator
heard,
Paraso, it's up to you. If you want to take
it. Mr. Chairman.
How long does it take?
Depends on how many questions you have.
Okay, so sounds like we'll take it in the next.
Sounds good.
Okay. Please adjourn.
Already then.
Do you know about that?
Yeah.
Well, I have like 30 bills I haven't heard yet.
Federal.
I've been trying to get through them all.
Don't we all love
them? I don't know how much money all that is. If people think they're going to get all that money, I don't know where that's going to come from. I don't
know what you know how these things are.
All. I'm kind of in the frame of mind that you know we have to be responsible, but I also know that what happens. I mean, you're right. I mean, you're never going to be aware.
Yeah, that puts you in a bad spot.
Trail from the tribe.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
It's a fair amount. But you're right. You know, I'm going to get into this dissertation about kids intrigued by railroad tracks, and they are. Because I used to sit down and listen to it. And I just love playing on the tracks.
I've been sending you.